the NBC News Radio broadcasting studios of KCAA 1050 AM, 102.3 FM, and 106.5 FM, located in beautiful, sunny California. Thanks for tuning into the Water Zone this afternoon. I'm Rob Starr, along with Mr. Chris Davies. And Chris, how are you doing today?
Splendid, Rob Starr. Thank you for asking.
It's going to be a good show today.
It is. We're finally into one full week. It was nice last week having the day off right in the middle of the week, but almost the end of a full week here.
Well, I'm tired. I just flew in from Northern California. My arms are killing me.
But they look pretty good, though.
But, yeah, I went to 13 stops in 3 days and 400 and something miles driving once I got up there.
Certainly no moss growing on your feet, for sure.
No, no, no. But I'm glad to be back.
Glad
to be at home. Anyway, got tons of stuff to do. Big
good.
Week.
Yep. A lot of news this week as well.
Absolutely.
On the waterfront.
And we have somebody who's very famous now. Well, this person was very famous before we knew her. We needed her more than she needed us. She's the purveyor of Maven's Notebook, Miss Chris Austin. Welcome, Chris. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you guys doing?
Good. Hey, we wanted to toot your horn, but we were told by our HR department we're not allowed to do that. So we're going to ask you to do your own. we want to, again, congratulate you on your most recent award. And can you kind of tell us, well, we know, but tell our listening audience what it was and how does it feel to get it?
Oh, you know, it's really great. It was really nice acknowledgement. It was from an organization called the Bay Institute, and they're actually an environmental organization that advocates for, better flows and things for San Francisco Bay as well as the Delta. And they honored me with an award for environmental journalism that a lot of really great journalists have gone before and won. So it was really an amazing honor and really nice to be recognized in that way. The environmental community, there's not a lot of funding that's available from them, let's just put it that way. I'm really funded more by the water districts and the water agencies, because they're the ones that, have the ability. And so it's great when an environmental organization recognizes my work and they understand that I'm not just a voice for the water agencies, but a voice for everybody in California water, which is what I try to be. I try to, I try to be as inclusive as possible of everybody's view.
Yeah.
The only time I don't really is if it's a personal attack rather than a debate on a viewpoint, bad language or unfounded allegations. We don't get personal on these things, but or if you're just factually wrong, sometimes some of these things, if it comes out and slaps your face, it's just wrong, then I can't. But for the most part, I can put up everybody's everything, which is really what I try to do. So it was great to be honored in that way.
And we're very honored to have you on our show all the time, and we do appreciate you. And I just
it's a lot of fun.
Well, we,
I get to talk to like the two people who read my blog.
Well, hey, we've missed you the last couple of weeks, actually, since you've been gone. But anybody who reads the blog and the content on it, right, gets deep into the matter of the material, knows that you keep a fairly neutral position, right? Geneva, Swiss, however you want to phrase it.
Yep. And I have to thank Mr. Mike Barron, because he's the one who turned me on to your Maven's Notebook. And ever since then, that's when we contacted you, and it was just awesome having you on the show and keeping you on the show. And I mean, we get a lot of responses from our listeners. And now we have a new email address for the show, which I'll give out later. I just got that up and going.
Exciting.
But we get lots of compliments. People tune in to hear what you say, and now they go read it every single day, so that's nice. And
very appreciative.
Yes, and we also Just so everybody knows, we don't have a stake in Maven's Notebook here at the Water Zone, but you can contribute and help sponsor that as well as an individual. And just go to mavensnotebook.com and read all about it and the information about sponsoring that. And it gives Chris a little bit more things to go forward with. And anything that our audience can do for you, we do appreciate that as well. So,
all right. So, Chris, what's happening in water news this week?
Well, you know, one thing that's important to bring up for, you know, our Southern California listeners is that Metropolitan has just pumped a whole bunch of money into their landscape transformation program. They're given now $1 per square foot of grass that you change over into something that's more water conservative. And if, depending on where you live, if you're a member agency of Metropolitan, there may be even more money in it for you.
Now, I know you're neutral in your reporting. We were at an Irrigation Association conference a couple of years ago, and a lady named Inge Biscona, who does our ag show, was on, who did a report showing that the money that was spent on the first time that was done, that if they took the same amount of money and invested it into the agriculture world, they would have saved, I don't know, 20 times more water, or a bigger, gigantic number. I don't remember what it was off the top.
With the same investment.
With the same investment. Because do you think, or do you know how much water, you know, was saved out of the residential kind of thing versus what it could have been in the other world of it?
Well, I'm not familiar with the numbers, but I will tell you this. Agriculture water conservation is really tricky because in a lot of instances in these basins, the water that they take off the field, the tail water, they put onto the next field, and sometimes it goes down the canal to another user. Also, that water trickles down through the roots and recharges the aquifer,
right,
which they then, again, will pump from and use. So, you know, while we all need, you know, agriculture uses the most water,
right,
in the state. Well, I mean, that the environment, and it's debatable, you know, which gets, you know, which,
I mean,
gets
couldn't it offset the pumping, you know, buying the pumping equipment and the energy charges and things? I'm always thinking, you know, where do they get the biggest bang for the buck?
It's really hard to say. And I think, you know, we all need to be efficient with our water, and that includes the farmers. But I'll also point out the farmers are also businessmen.
Right.
And this water is a major input to their crop, and especially with, you know, water rates that they're paying. There are some in the Central Valley with very old contracts from the Bureau of Reclamation, and they get it for really cheap. But there are also a lot of farmers in Kern County, for example, that pay $300 or more per acre foot of water. So pumping costs, they're very familiar with too. So it's like, farmers or businessmen, they don't waste the water. It's easy to kind of, you know, look at it, you know, and sometimes sprinklers are wasteful. Sometimes sprinklers are the way to irrigate that particular crop. Not every field should be flooded. Not every field should be micro drip irrigated either, depending on the crop that you're growing.
Right.
There's so much texture to the issue of agriculture and saving water that it's hard to just go off the cuff and say they should be using less. You know, it's not appropriate for every field to be using micro drip irrigation depending on the crop that they're growing.
Of course.
You know, so it's, and not every field can grow every kind of crop. So
no. Well, I understand, you know, Chris had sent me a copy, Chris here, had sent me a copy of this rebate. And right. I guess you can't replace it with artificial turf or anything like
right.
that.
It can't be used for artificial turf, right? I mean, but they're calling it the Landscape Transformation Program, but it really is similar to what they did, to what ended 3 years ago, which was the turf
removal
rebate program,
yeah.
right? I mean, this is essentially the same thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, I want to say I am not against people having grass. It's just there's a lot of places where we are using grass where it's never walked upon.
Well, it's like like medians in the road. I think that's a silly place to have it. And, you know, cars are driving back and forth. And, you know, personally, I don't care if it's real grass or not, you know, or phony grass. It's just green and it looks nice. And, you know, especially when you're driving 60 miles an hour down the freeway, you could care less about that. But I know I know we had Caltrans on, and they're trying to eliminate all kinds of overhead sprinkling systems and things of that sort. So that's I'm not against it. I think any way that we can help to conserve water is a good thing to do, because we're going to need to do that going
forward.
And
I think that, you know, what it's the areas where grass is that it doesn't need to be. Those are the areas we need to address. If you have a family and you have a backyard and you use it, then by all means, you know, you should have grass and you
have
should
a lawn.
Water that.
Right.
But, you know, if you have a front yard that nobody ever walks on, you know, maybe you could do something better that saves water.
Yeah. I was glad to see, Chris, in the press release that the Met put out, that they're looking at, they put other requirements in there, right, to drive the sustainability part of the program. Obviously working on lessons they learned from the first time around. But you know, let's see how it comes about and how it gets driven down to the consumer this time, because these rebates are going to the water agencies versus direct to the consumer.
Yeah, and you know, water-wise landscaping doesn't mean cactus and rock.
Right.
It can mean other things that can be quite lovely. So you know, we shouldn't always think that's what. You know, you rip out your grass and you must go to cactus and ugly rock.
Yeah, well, you know, the last time they did it, right, I mean, it spawned a mini industry, if you will, right? I mean, there were reputable as well as unreputable contractors that were going and taking advantage of this program. So,
there were some conversions that were going on that if someone came out and did that to my front lawn, I would cry.
Uh-huh.
No other way to put it.
Well, there's even stories about Los Angeles with the Mayor Garcetti, that he was involved in some of those companies and getting kickbacks and stuff. It wasn't proven, but you know how rumors start. But anyway, I think whatever we can do to help conserve water and use it more wisely is a smart thing to do anyway.
And all of our resources, quite honestly, electricity and everything. You know, we should only use what we need.
Right.
Yeah. And but you're right, Chris. Right. It's sustainability is important. How you do the transformation is important. I mean, you want somebody to come out there and just with a turf splitter and just rip up your turf, throw down a couple of yards of decomposed granite, some DG, and then throw in a couple of ceanothus or something. Right. I mean, it's got to be done right in order to be sustainable.
Yeah, and nobody should feel guilty because they have a patch of grass in their yard that they use.
Right.
You know, nobody, we're not to that point yet. And I think that, you know, having grass adds a lot of value in you know, certain instances and keeps it cool. And I know I'm not supposed to take any position, so don't take this personally, but I'm not a big fan of artificial turf.
I'm not either, but...
You're in good company.
So, yeah.
Well, we're supposed to see a lot. You know, we're supposed to see social media on this. Oh, even TV commercials, right? In as I remember reading in the press release.
Yeah.
So it's going to be prevalent.
Now has conservation ads going all the time. I don't think they ever quite stopped after the drought. They've continued to remind us all that we need to be careful with this.
Yeah, that's true. So you were saying that Met also decided to spend $11 million on Delta tunnels?
Oh, well, actually, you know, Metropolitan on Tuesday had to take another vote on whether they would go for supporting the building the entire Delta Tunnel project, which is something that they voted back, I think it was in April or May. But there were some allegations of Brown Act violations, that being the code that people can't be discussing and making decisions not in an open forum. You know, directors should not be calling up each other and, you know, persuading votes and
we want
all.
Transparency.
Yeah, yeah. And Metropolitan disputed the allegations, but nonetheless, they decided to take a revote. And it was clear, you know, listening to the meeting that, you know, some of the directors really were had a problem with some of the things that sort of came out in the public record request.
Right.
But nonetheless, they voted to continue to, you know, to fund the rest of the Delta Tunnels project that currently is unfunded. So it goes beyond the amount that Metropolitan would have to pay for on their own. With the idea that this extra capacity will be sold to Central Valley farmers or other people who, you know, it's been hard for Central Valley Project, that's the federal farmers, to participate in this because they have a whole different contract system and a whole different thing going on. I guess that's the easiest way to say it. So the bet that Metropolitan is making is that, you know, that the farmers can come and make deals, or the district can come and make deals with Metropolitan directly to get some of this water. And Metropolitan is betting that that's what's going to happen. And, you know, I have to tell you, you know, with the fact that there's now groundwater regulation in the San Joaquin Valley, and on top of that, last week, the State Water Board released their proposal for flow requirements for all the rivers in the Sacramento and San Joaquin basins. And they are saying that more water needs to be left in the streams in order to, you know, so we can continue to have our native fish, like the Delta smelt that maybe you don't care about, but like the salmon, which a lot of people do care about.
Can you eat the Delta smelt? I know they're so tiny, like sardines.
It's not a bait fish and all that. It's, you know, but it's kind of an indicator, and it's pretty much thought to be just about extinct. We don't know if there's going to be any more.
I mean, I see its popularity if you substitute them for the anchovies on pizza. Maybe have a better taste.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, but salmon. It's no joking matter.
No, absolutely not.
California salmon, you know, if your salmon is from California, I mean, most of it is coming out of the Delta. And
right.
There are fishermen who, you know, fish for salmon, and that's how they make a living. And when the salmon runs, they're dying. And this is a big issue.
Yeah, understand.
So, and it's not easy. So, but rolling that back to Metropolitan's tunnel decision, you know, the Central Valley farmers now basically are being told you're going to have to manage your groundwater sustainably, meaning you can't, you know, pump it till it's dry. And the State Water Board is saying you're going to get less water out of the rivers because we want you to leave it in. So Central Valley farmers are going to want that water from Metropolitan. There's to me, I don't see any way around that.
No, that's true. Last question I have for you, both Chris's.
Yeah.
I had heard briefly today on the way in about a city in California, and I don't recall which one it was. They were complaining that they had really brown water with deep sediment in it, and their water agency didn't hold public meetings to talk about it.
That's the Sativa Water District. I think it serves about 1,800 customers
down
in the Compton area, which is really kind of small. It's a, you know, probably a legacy water system from, you know, when we were all small little Los Angeles, a lot of small little towns all growing together.
Right.
But, yeah, they've been unable to, you know, deliver clean water, and so a vote was taken, and they're going to dissolve that water district and figure out how to fold it into one of the larger systems in the area.
Great idea.
Yeah, good news for these people that have had to deal with brown water.
Yeah, I have a hard line against water agencies, small ones that and maybe some of the government officials who let that happen for years. It's terrible. No one should be able to drink crappy water. Sorry, that's just my
thing. Yeah, exactly. We know how to deliver clean water to people's houses.
Yep.
We do. That's absolutely true. And not just, you know, drink it, but they have to bathe in it. They have to cook with it, right? I mean, it's everything.
Oh, yeah.
You want to give it to little babies and kids and even adults. I mean, that's just wrong.
Well, also, when you realize these, especially those in the Central Valley, these farm workers who make, you know, hardly any money anyways, and they have to pay for the crappy water that comes out of their faucets, but they have to go and buy bottled water.
No, being a human being in the United States, no one should be able to drink lousy water. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no one should have to. You're right.
Yeah. Hey, back on the conservation issue, right? I saw an article, Chris, from U.S. Geological Survey. It was a report that came out that says, as of this year, or as of the end of 2017, actually, that the per capita home water conservation as compared to 1970 levels was 9% lower than it was back then. That just amazes me, and you know that's also corroborated, I think, if I remember reading that article, from average monthly water withdrawals that were registered by each state and reported to the U.S. Geological Survey. So when you look at water conservation and, you know, all the efforts that were going on, it really tells us that this is a journey, right? Not a destination. There's no end to it, and it's the new reality.
That's absolutely true. And, you know, I would have to confess that I think that a lot of that water savings has come from the easy, low-hanging fruit. Making our appliances more water efficient, using low flow toilets, things that we don't have to really think about, just purchase the fixture and it does the job for you. I think we're starting to move into the zone, though, where we're going to have to start thinking more about how we're using the water and not just counting on efficiency of appliances to make it all up for us.
Where in Asia, I heard this the other day, maybe one of you two could tell me, that in one of the Asian countries, they have a big water issue, and they're now making a law that you have to shower or bathe together.
Didn't hear that one.
I'm not joking. I'm really serious about it, but I don't recall what. I'll have to look that up, but I did hear it the other day on the radio. It was someplace in Asia.
I wouldn't be surprised. My husband traveled to the Philippines, and he said that in the Philippines it's very humid and they shower twice a day. Although, he said, the water is not hot. There's no water heater. And they don't stay in there very long.
And they sell mussels on the sides of the roads as you travel through the different provinces. And it comes from the most disgusting-looking water that you've ever seen. And they have barrels of these sitting by the sides of the roads as you're driving by. And people stop and buy these. And it's just...
Yeah, I mean it's different out there. You know, I think it was Brazil or somebody was advocating, you know, you should just urinate in the shower, pee in the shower when you take your shower. Don't go to the toilet.
Well, it'll save a gallon.
Yeah. Well, why not? You know.
Yeah, goes to the same place, I presume.
Probably.
Pretty sure it does. All right, so last on the list here, as I was thinking about the Metropolitan Waters Landscape Transformation Program, I just wanted to tag onto that a bit because I wanted to mention earlier when we were talking about the parameters around it and how the Met is going to do it, right? Changing out a lawn carte blanche without thinking about it, without doing a water audit, without doing anything like that, right? So maybe some of the requirements as we start to refine these programs, and the Met does, should include some of the new science that's around water conservation, like water audits and how easy they are to do. But, you know, you rarely see that mentioned anymore.
Oh, yeah, and, you know, there's a lot to that. And no, you really do have to plan these landscape changeovers.
Wildlife habitats, another issue that can be a benefit from landscape transformation
and pollinators.
Right.
Oh my word! We had a garden, and we were having a heck of a time getting our vegetables and everything to grow. So my husband went and got some flowers and put them in there in the garden and set up a little bee thing. And what do you know? Now we have fruit and vegetables coming out of our garden. But it really does make a difference.
Yeah, probably up until the early or mid 1980s, I wasn't really concerned with that. I wasn't a gardening fan or things like that. But when I started doing it, I mean, I caught the bug, and it's been a lifelong hobby for me. You know, I've got a half acre lot with a native garden, and I still have plenty of lawn, right? Enough to play croquet on. So there is a balance, Chris, I guess, is what I'm trying to promote.
And if you use your lawn, then you should have it. Hey.
Yeah.
Do you have a problem with brown snails?
I do not, no.
Oh, no, I do not either, but I have to say a lot of people out here do, and the reason why I don't is that this has been hot topic for us out here on the Next Door program, the old Facebook for Neighbors. I bought decollet snails there about 15 years ago. They're a predator of brown snails. They eat just the dead, your dead plant matter and the eggs of the brown snails, and I populated my yard with them, and 15 years later I do not have any brown snails.
That's a good success story.
It is, and it cost me $20, and that was 15 years ago, and still to this day no brown snails.
All right, Chris, we're gonna take a little break here, and we will hope you'll be back next week. Oh, actually, next week is our Ag Show.
Ag Show.
Next week is Ag Show?
Yeah, so we'll have you in. Well, actually.
No, I don't think it is.
Well, tell you what. I'll call you during the week because maybe we can still have you come on.
Okay. I'm always happy to come in and talk water.
Absolutely. We love you.
So, you're awesome, Chris.
All right, so stick around for the second half. We'll be back with Chris and Rob here on the Water Zone, and we'll be right back again.
Good night, guys.
Good night.
Did you know that an irrigation system that has a leak of just 1/32nd of an inch in diameter, that's the thickness of a dime, wastes 6,300 gallons of water per month or 75,000 gallons per year? Well, with more solvent cement experience than anyone on the planet, Weldon formulates their products not just to meet a standard, but to exceed it. Weldon products are designed to provide even greater safety margins, often able to make up for common mistakes or less than ideal installation conditions, reducing the chance for leaks and costly callbacks. Weldon's invention of solvent cement over 60 years ago revolutionized the piping industry. From day one, Weldon has led the industry with their broad range of high-performing solvent cements, primers, and cleaners, bringing unique solutions to professional contractors and homeowners. Along the way, Weldon has earned the loyalty of millions of professional contractors who trust their products and depend on their outstanding customer service, live technical hotline, troubleshooting services, and free training. And because they care about the environment, Weldon was the first manufacturer to develop and offer a complete line of low VOC cements. Their hottest formulation is Weldon 750 Hot Weld, a one-step, fast-setting blue PVC solvent cement specifically formulated for superior, long-term, trouble-free performance. So whether you're a professional contractor or just a backyard do-it-yourselfer, choose Weldon, the trusted global leader in solvent cements for leak-free plastic piping systems. To learn more about their complete line of products or technical training, visit the web at www.weldon.com or call their technical service hotline at 877-477-8327.
Let's talk drought stress. No one likes burnt plants or grass, especially your customers. So when it's hotter than a tin roof in Tallahassee, what are you gonna do? Water the problem away? Not only does that abuse a vital resource, it's illegal in many cities. Here's a quick and easy solve that won't get you in trouble with Mother Nature or Johnny Law. Applied is a year-round program. Moisture Manager from LESCO supplements regular irrigation by attracting moisture to treated areas, thus making the moisture available to plant roots. This maintains wettability between waterings and rainfall, allowing soil to accept water as it becomes available, and making the water more accessible to the plant roots. Boom! More green, less watering, and a great new reason to see your customers on a recurring basis. With LESCO Moisture Manager and Site One, high heat is no sweat.
Okay, welcome back to the second half of the Water Zone. And Chris, you got some updates on the IA events?
Yeah, actually, one of the exciting parts about the Irrigation Association Smart Irrigation Month, which is July, by the way, is that the IA announces their annual industry award winners, right? So that was announced, I believe, on the 9th, or the press release went out on July 9th. So there's three awards altogether: the Industry Achievement Award, then the Vanguard Award, and then the Excellence in Education Award. So just wanted to take a minute to congratulate the winners of that. We'll help with the with announcing it on the Water Zone show here. So the Industry Achievement Award this year goes to Jim Clouser. He's from Clearwater Supply in Ontario, and he got that award for driving significant increases in the use of efficient irrigation technology. So congratulations there for Jim.
Ontario where?
Ontario, Oregon. Sorry, my
just
fault.
Just want to make sure.
Right. Good point. The second award, the Vanguard Award, that's really an award that's given to for innovative irrigation projects. There's two Vanguard Awards that were issued. First one was to Conserva Irrigation, well known in the irrigation industry for their work.
Good group of guys,
yeah, for their work on water savings by changing the irrigation services approach, right? So it's they're 2 years into this project, and they're doing it with the Target Corporation. So they've called it a sustainability project, and so far saved about 36 million gallons for the Target Corporation. So congrats to Conserva. Second Vanguard Award goes to Netafim USA and their variable drip irrigation project, or VRDI, right, with Gallo Vineyards, and that resulted in...
Altering to that?
Yeah. You took the words right out of my mouth. So, you know, increased yields and improved water use efficiency, so... Great sound effects. Yeah. All right. The third award was the Excellent in Education Awards, and it's an Irrigation Association Foundation Award for excellence, and it's awarded to the educator or teacher or somebody who formerly taught irrigation. This year, it went to Franklin Gowdy, who is from Cal Poly San Luis Obispo. You know, the Rio Cal Poly.
Yep. Congratulations.
Yeah. So congrats to Franklin. So. We have a great guest lined up now, Rob.
Yes, we do. We have Mr. Michael Marcus. He's the general manager of the Orange County Groundwater Authority, and we caught up with him at a recent Orange County Water event. And so here we go. Well, we're here with Mr. Michael Marcus. He's the general manager for Orange County's Groundwater Authority. And he's joining us from the Water What's Behind the Magic Symposium put on by Orange County Water, Metropolitan Water District of Orange County, if I say it correctly. I have Anaheim Utilities, but so used to saying that all day long. Can you tell us a little about what Orange County Groundwater Authority is and does?
Well, we're the Orange County Water District, and what we do is we oversee and manage a very large groundwater basin in central and northern Orange County. In this area of Orange County, which is approximately 2.5 million people, they are able to pump groundwater as 75% of the water that they use. So that's very important, because those cities then only have to rely on 25% of their supply from imported sources. We call imported water that we receive from the Colorado River or Northern California. And the significance of that is groundwater costs about half of what imported water does. So our overall cost of water supply is lower because of this groundwater basin.
Now, your program has been pretty successful. I've been to one of the demonstrations where they have a glass and he passes it around and anybody wants to take a drink. And some people are reluctant to do that, but it's amazing at what you can do and how important that is here. And other places like in Los Angeles is trying to, they're doing it. But you guys were sort of a pioneer here to push that forward.
Yeah, we have been pioneers. You're right. And it's funny because it really started back in the 1970s. We built a facility in Fountain Valley in Orange County here, which was called Water Factory 21. And that facility was the first facility in the world to use reverse osmosis technology to treat wastewater and turn it into nearly distilled quality water. So we've been familiar with reverse osmosis technology for over 40 years. Right. And in fact, had that facility, it supplied water to the groundwater basin, and we have a seawater barrier also. The water supplied water to the barrier. And then the project you referred to, the groundwater replenishment system, replaced the old water factory. So the groundwater replenishment system provides 100 million gallons of highly purified recycled water as a source of supply for our groundwater basin.
Do you, you know, since it's been so successful, have you shared, I mean, I'm sure you publish documents and things and go to symposiums all over the country and maybe all over the world. Has any other places outside California really started to adopt stuff like this?
Yeah, the kind of the first major implementer was actually the country of Singapore. And they're a very interesting case in point because they used to be a part of Malaysia. They seceded mm-hmm. from Malaysia, and yet were totally dependent on their water supply from Malaysia. And so they had to develop their own sources of supply, and they turned to recycled water. In fact, when we were doing our testing of the technology back in the mid-1990s, Singapore came over, and we shared our pilot testing on the microfiltration and the reverse osmosis and the UV technologies with them, and then they moved forward and implemented a little bit quicker than we did, but they implemented it. It's part of their water supply. So they have quite a few facilities actually on the island that provide a major portion of their water supply. And then we've had others. These types of projects have been developed in Texas. Certainly San Diego is looking at developing mm-hmm. one. They're in the final design of what they call their Pure Water Project. LA is looking at a similar type project. Up in the Bay Area, Santa Clara Valley Water District has implemented a 10 million gallon per day advanced purification facility. So we're starting to see more and more being developed and put into implementation. And then even the Orange County Water District, we're looking at our final expansion. We started out at 70 million gallons. We then expanded to 100 million gallons, and we have the capacity to go to 130 million gallons. So we're in the final design right now for our final expansion, and hopefully in about 4 years we'll be up and running at 130 million gallons per day, which would be enough water for 1 million people.
Excellent.
How much of your connection base, your customers, your clients, are aware of the technology that you're using to...
You know, probably not as many as we'd like to. I often
do you have outreach and things like that?
Oh, we have tremendous outreach. And we had to have outreach really when we started implementing our original recycled water plant. So we started in the late 90s when we were, even before we started the design of the original project mm-hmm. with the outreach, because we knew what can happen.
Projects, well, that's 20 years ago, yeah.
That was a long time ago, and the outreach has been ongoing also. We give tours of the facility, we have a speakers bureau, we go out and we talk to people, and we do try to spread the word. We get a tremendous amount of people from all over the world that visit us and take a look at what we're doing as well. But it still really isn't enough. And I often say that as a water community, the water community in general, really does a poor job of communicating to people, to educating people as to where their water comes from. We all take it for granted, right? In the morning we turn the spigot on, the water comes out, and yet we don't realize how that water got to our house.
Right.
You know, just the plumbing within the house, and then to go outside into the street, and then to a reservoir and a pump station, mm-hmm. and it may have come from an aqueduct from the Colorado River, Northern California. No clue. We just know it always comes out. And I mean, part of that is a testimony to the water industry that it is so reliable, that we have such reliable, safe drinking water. Right. But we really need to educate people as to where the water comes from and have them develop a what I call a water ethic on how we use our water.
Sure.
Because we use quite a bit of water. I think we do a nice job of tracking the usage inside the house. Low flush toilets, low flow shower heads. I mean, we all have those.
Right.
It's on the outside where most of the water is used, where we need to dial it back a little bit.
Right.
And that's where, like I said, if we start thinking about things, we can do that. Hey, let's put my timer on 3 times a week. It's raining. Let's turn it off.
Mm-hmm.
And when we start developing that ethic, I think we'll see, we'll be able to kind of increase the population just like we've done, and not necessarily increase the water demands.
Yeah, outreach can be very valuable unless you have an uninterested or an apathetic audience, right? They don't really know about it or they're not interested in it. So being able to reach those customers and make the value and the importance of the technology you're using, that's a big important part of it. I think we see that in millennials and young people today. But those of us who grew up without conservation in the beginning, it's sort of like,
do you think that the public really understands the true value of water? As an example, we all can go to the gas station and put gas in our cars. We take the nozzle, stick it in, and you can watch the pump go. And you can see, oh, I'm up to $10, I'm up to $20, I'm up to $60. But they know that instantaneously. They know it right then and there. Mm-hmm. Unlike our water bills, you don't know until you
after
get the bill. Yeah, after the fact to do that. And so I don't know if the public really understands the true value. We've had people, and we've met and been on our show, the Consul General of Israel, another author from New York, a gentleman named Seth Siegel, wrote a book called Let There Be Water. He's been on twice and things. And they were explaining how they recycle water. And we were surprised to learn that their enemies around them buy water from Israel, and how much Israel recycles the water, and how they mine it, how they take the toilet paper, I guess is the way he told it to me, and they take that and they recycle that, the oils that are in there, they take that out, and then that's resold again. And how, I know that their system is different, it's operated by the government, but they're very strict. But they said even the kids at school know you don't turn this water on or you don't do this. We don't have that yet here.
No, and it's interesting. I think that where it really starts is educating the children.
Hmm.
At the Orange County Water District, we have an annual event called the Children's Education Water Festival. And it's a two-day event, third, fourth, and fifth graders. We get over 7,000 students in that two-day period. And they just go to different tents where they have hands-on type activities, and we try to, you know, they'll take that home and then they'll tell their parents and educate their parents. But it really has to start, I think, with them, and then kind of trickle up. So if we can get something in the curriculum
mm-hmm.
that would help them in the classroom, not just a 1 or 2 day event,
right.
but something in the curriculum that teaches them about water, I think that certainly would be a major step in the right direction.
How can that be communicated to the superintendent of schools in California? I mean, is there ongoing conversation with them to say, hey, let's talk about this, and can we include this as a subject versus some of the ones that they're doing today?
You know, it's not being talked about, and that's the problem. And that's, where I say we as a water community are falling down. However, we are starting, I know at the district with my public affairs staff, we are starting to have these conversations, have the conversations with others. It'll have to percolate up through maybe an association like AQUA, the Association of California Water Agencies, to get to the state superintendent and start promoting these ideas. But I think that's really one of the keys, because you're right. I mean, people do kind of ignore the water bill.
Sure.
I think to a large extent, it's because it's so inexpensive.
Yeah.
I mean, mine, it's just my wife and I now, but we live in a four-bedroom home and no pool, but it's only about $30 a month. Right. And so you take it for granted. The cost of water probably is underpriced.
It's like when the gas got up in my neighborhood. Most of the people are, you know, upper middle class, and they have company cars and the credit mm-hmm. cards. So it's, I don't care if it's $4 for gas, and they plop it in and do that. But the water is a different thing, and it's unfortunate that people don't know. As we were talking to Fritz Coleman a few minutes ago, you know. Just think if a major earthquake hits and damages our major water. I mean, I still want to see somebody in legislation say the top three issues are, you know, this, and this, and water should be one of those top three. Because you can't build any more homes. You can't have hospitals. You can't grow food. You can't live without water. And to me, that should be one of the major things. With all this stuff that they're building or they're spending money on, and I won't go into it here, but I'm trying not to be political, but there's a lot of things that they're spending money on. And I'm nervous because when I hear things like they were talking about this possible tax this morning, you know, how do I know that the money is going to go to that? Every time I hear something like that, a year down the road, oh, well, they took the money from this, like we're supposed to fix the roads. They take the money from that, divert it somewhere else, and yet we're paying money on it. And nobody holds them accountable for it. I guess the only way we do is when we vote for them, but the same people keep getting in and in. It just gets blindsided.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And water does drive the economy. I mean, there's no doubt about it. And water is a necessity of life. Mm-hmm. And, you know, right now, I think the way that things are handled, the system works well. You have the local control. I think that's important that people have that type of control to mm-hmm. decide whether they want to develop the projects, whether they want to spend the money to mm-hmm. develop the projects. I mean, our recycled water program, by the time we're done with it, it's a capital investment of $900 million. Yeah. And our O&M costs are about $20 million a year. So it's a commitment. But we can still produce the water at a lower cost than imported water, so it makes sense, and we have the water supply reliability. We don't have to worry about cutbacks on the Delta or drought on the Colorado River. Our recycled water delivers the same amount of water every day.
I'd be interested to know, to what level do you treat that recycled water before you put it back into a recharge basin, I'm assuming, so it can percolate down into the aquifer?
We treat it to an extremely high level. So the water that we receive the wastewater from the Orange County Sanitation mm-hmm. District. So that's a different agency, and they treat the municipal and the industrial waste mm-hmm. in the same service area, the same 2.5 million people. So they treat that wastewater. Mm-hmm. They treat it to what's called secondary mm-hmm. levels, such that it's safe to discharge to the ocean. But instead of discharging it to the ocean, we want to
pull it back,
capture it. We want to pull it back in. We do not consider wastewater a waste. We consider it a resource. Mm-hmm. And then we run it through this advanced treatment process. So we run it through microfiltration,
right.
Which removes all the bacteria, the protozoa, the suspended solids in the water. And then it goes through reverse osmosis, which really is the workhorse mm-hmm. of the treatment process. So the reverse osmosis will remove any of the dissolved minerals, viruses, pharmaceuticals.
Any UV
out of the water. The UV is the final step. So reverse osmosis removes just about everything except some really, really small organic compounds.
And do you add more salts back or anything back into it?
Well, first we send it through the UV, and the UV gets rid of the organics. Now, the water, as we've stripped out almost all the minerals out of the water. So we do have to add some lime back into the water to stabilize it. If we did not add some minerals back at the end of the process, when we put the water in our cement mortar lined piping, the water would try to leach the minerals out mm-hmm. of the cement lining. And over time, dissolve
right.
it. So we do add a little bit of mineral back into the water, but not that much.
A lot of homeowners or businesses talk to us about our products, and again, we don't promote. It's not our business to promote our product on the radio. But one of the interesting things they said, well, you know, you can get non-potable water, and why should you know? It's so cheap, and we don't have to worry about it. And I go, well, there's only a certain amount of that available at the moment. So I'm sure down the road when it gets scarce, economic stress is going to raise. Plus, you can't put in a whole new system to a house that's already existing and have the water agency put a whole new piping system in so they can, I mean, that's ripping up every street, everything to deliver a secondary system, which I can't see is ever going to happen to that.
Well, it happens to a lesser degree. So non-potable recycled water, you're right. It requires less treatment than what we currently provide. So it would just be the equivalent of taking that secondary effluent and running it through our first step, mm-hmm. microfiltration. Then you could take that water and use it for irrigation purposes, right. Golf courses, green belts. But you're right, it takes a separate system. You have to run to handle that that non-potable water. Often it's put in purple pipes. Mm-hmm. So it's referred to as purple pipe water.
Right.
Yeah.
But that's non-potable, tertiary treated water
pipes. What I don't see, and Chris and I were talking about this a couple of weeks ago, you go to the Parks and Recreation Department, city things, where they use the non-potable water. And they take a regular hose, put it green, brown, black, whatever, squirts. But it's non-potable water. Why shouldn't it be purple? Because people don't know. I mean, people know that purple means that. So I can imagine some kids picking this up. Hey, it's just a regular hose. Let's take a drink of water and stuff like that. But there's no regulation to say that if you're using that kind of system, everything should be purple that's attached to it.
it is up to the spigot. The spigot has to be clearly identified.
Right. Yes.
But you're right. If you hook a hose up to it and then turn it on, no one has an idea if
it's that a hose person is, user, right? Yeah. So it's up to it's up to them to do that. But
it's not a bad idea. I like that, actually. Purple hose for non-reclaimable water.
Yep. I have seen just recently in the last, it's just the first part of this year in Utah and in Florida where I visited, where developers now are being required to build new homes with potable and non-potable piping.
And I'm sure they pay for that, or they have...
Right? And we had the opportunity to sit down with a couple of developers and ask them, you know, some questions. And you'd be surprised, it's not that much more to the cost of the home. Because it's not internal piping, right? The drainage part is and the collection part is. But to deliver it to use in that home or back into a municipal water system is not that expensive.
The thing you have to worry about, though, is cross connections.
Yeah, absolutely.
If someone digs up the purple pipe in their front yard and taps into it and then uses it. So.
Exactly. But the very thing that was the first thing that came up when we were talking to those guys.
So you attended this event today. What is the biggest takeaway that you got as a water agency?
Yeah, I think the biggest takeaway, I mean, the theme kind of was unintended consequences. I think there was today, the thing for me was one of the sessions that talked about the water tax, the Monning bill, and the alternatives that might be available in lieu of the Monning bill. So I was particularly, I think, impressed with Paul Jones's talk from Eastern, the general manager from Eastern Municipal, and what Eastern has done in developing the legislation that they're pushing, which to me seems like a more practical approach to try to consolidate those smaller districts and then maybe have a single provider provide the water. That seems like a very sensible and cost-effective way to handle the problem, because it is a problem and it has been a problem.
You know, we all knew about the Flint, Michigan thing, but we were surprised right after that to hear about all the places in California that are having problems like that. And I agree with, you know, I'm sensitive to the thing that we're all human beings and we should treat people as human beings and you don't give them dirty or contaminated water. I totally agree with that. But I also think that legislatures should talk more with water people. And I know they say they do, but before they launch this thing off to go do and think of all the alternatives, they don't. It's always easy to say let's tax and never get to the root cause. And so I'm glad I heard some of that today. And
yeah, I think it was very well thought out, because I agree with you. Sometime I think legislators will take kind of a knee-jerk reaction to things and say, yeah, the tax is the easy way to do it. We'll just charge everyone and then we'll figure out what to do with the money. But it appears the legislation that Eastern is proposing is very well thought out and has a de minimis impact fiscally for the state of California.
Now, just a silly question. I know when they started recycling this water, the terms from all the news people were toilet to tap.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think you promote it that way anymore. Or was that a smarter way to do it at the beginning? Was it a good thing to do, or that you realized maybe it shouldn't be that way, or does it scare people?
You know, I think it could scare people. That was mainly used by opponents of the project in San Diego back in the late 90s. Mm-hmm. And it had also been used up in the San Gabriel Valley, where a similar type project was being developed at a similar time. And yeah. There again, it's just a matter of educating people. You go, no, this is not toilet to tap. Toilet to tap implies it goes from the toilet straight into the water system, right?
That was pretty interesting, and we're going to continue that on the next show so we know a little bit more about what's happening. Anyway, most important thing is to, when you go home, is to think blue. Everybody had a good evening, and we'll catch you next week. Have a good one.
Bye, everyone.
KCAA Loma Linda, 1050 AM, 106.5.